You're listening to Veracity Radio. Next up, Matthew Alexander and How to Break a Terrorist.
As you know, coalition forces killed Zarqawi and one of his top lieutenants, Sheikh al-Rahman, yesterday on June 7th at 6:15 p.m. in an airstrike against an identified, isolated safe house. The success was a product of painstaking intelligence gathering from local sources and from within, made possible both by the Iraqis, who have made the determination to uphold the legitimate authority in their own nation, and the slow, deliberate exploitation of leads person to person through evidence since December of 2003. The elimination of Zarqawi has dealt a serious blow to al-Qaeda in Iraq.
I think arguably over the last several years, no single person on this planet has had the blood of more innocent men, women, and children on his hands than Zarqawi. He personified the dark, sadistic, and medieval vision of the future of beheadings, suicide bombings, and indiscriminate killings. A behavior pattern that has been rejected by the overwhelming majority of the Iraqi people, whether Sunni, Shias, or Kurds, and certainly by the overwhelming majority of Muslims worldwide.
On June 7, 2006, the United States Department of Defense announced the death of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. The narrative to his relevance was that he was the head of a faction of al-Qaeda in Iraq. At the time of his death, the generational tensions between Sunni and Shia were now dripping blood in the streets of Iraq, and the claim was that he was promoting this strife as a way to drive Americans out of Iraq. And while the American audience was being fed nightly stories about insurgents and terrorists, the story wasn't as black and white as presented. In his book, How to Break a Terrorist, Matthew Alexander covers the inner narrative of his experience in Iraq as a senior interrogator who was sent to Iraq nearly 2 years after the breaking of the Abu Ghraib abuses and the dog and pony accountability show. I asked Mr. Alexander about his arrival and the cultural shift necessary in his corps of interrogators, or as they call themselves, Gators. So, I'm joined here with Matthew Alexander. Matthew, will you tell us what your role is? You were an officer in the military, in the Air Force, is that correct?
Yes, at the time that I was an interrogator, I was an activated reservist for the Air Force.
And you were a major?
Yes, I was.
Okay. Before you were sent to Iraq, you had been a criminal investigator, is that correct?
That's correct. I worked for the Air Force as a criminal investigator and also a counterintelligence agent. I mean, I joined the military straight out of college. I went through ROTC, and I joined up right after I graduated university. I was a pilot for 6 years, and then I went to grad school that the Air Force paid for, and then eventually I became a counterintelligence agent and criminal investigator for the Air Force, and eventually an interrogator. But it was really sort of a series of fortunate events. One that in 2005 I went into the reserves and began immediately to volunteer to go to either Iraq or Afghanistan. And shortly thereafter, there was an opportunity to go become an interrogator to support a task force in Iraq. And so I volunteered for that.
So you arrived in early 2006?
That's correct.
So there was roughly about 2 years between Abu Ghraib, the Abu Ghraib scandal hitting the press, and your arrival. Is that correct?
That's about right, yeah.
So how would you describe the difference between what was happening in regarding interrogation in Iraq before your arrival and after?
Well, let me start by saying that, you know, my background, having come from criminal investigations, we have techniques that we use in criminal investigations that are different than the ones that are in the Army Field Manual to to use for intelligence interrogations. So when I was going through the Army interrogator training for Huachuca, I started to notice that some of the techniques that I had used as crew investigator weren't taught in the Army Corps. And the rationale that some people have given is that they're designed to get confessions, which is different than trying to get intelligence information. That's true that the objective of it is different, but it's not true that the technique itself can't convince. Whether it's an Army technique or a law enforcement technique, they're both designed ultimately to get somebody to change their mind, to decide to cooperate. So when I arrived in Iraq, what I found is that there was some people who were conducting interrogations in a manner in which they could say that they were legal but were not in line with the spirit of the law or the Detainee Treatment Act of 2005, outlawed enhanced interrogation techniques, and re-emphasized that the minimum standard was humane treatment. And so what I did is, originally I was just interrogating, and I started to use some law enforcement techniques and teach them to other interrogators. And then eventually I took over one of the interrogation teams, and I taught that team different ways that they could integrate law enforcement techniques into their interrogation.
So if you had to give a percentage of the efficacy of these techniques before you arrived and after, how would you measure that?
Well, it's hard to measure, quantifiably,
okay,
the success of interrogation techniques for a couple of reasons. One is it's not digital. In other words, someone cooperated or didn't cooperate. There's levels of cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
It's very rare that you have somebody who gives you everything they know, and it's also fairly rare that somebody gives you absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's somewhere in the middle where a large majority of people fall. What I can tell you is that there's no doubt in my mind, objectively, from watching interrogations, over 1,000 interrogations, that the amount of cooperation that we received from detainees increased when we used, when we made two changes. One is we integrated some law enforcement techniques,
mm-hmm,
and used those very effectively, a couple of which I talk about in my book, for instance, the boss introduction. Some of them I'm also spelling out in my next book, which will be out next winter,
okay,
which has to do with doing point-of-capture interrogations in the field where law enforcement techniques are also very applicable. But the other big change that I made and helped institute, the way we approached the cultural aspect of interrogations.
I found that very fascinating, by the way. That was the part I think makes the book come alive.
And this, I would say, is if I actually had to choose between changing techniques to include law enforcement or just changing the fact of how we use the techniques in light of the culture, I would do the latter, because culture is, understanding the culture and correct understanding the culture is fundamental to conducting good interrogations. And so when I arrived, the problem was that people were still stuck on these very ignorant stereotypes about Muslims and Arabs and people who had joined Al-Qaeda. That they were all religious fanatics, or that they only understood violence, and all types of wrong stereotypes. And when
this wasn't limited to your immediate supervisors and or colleagues. This was fairly high up.
Well, there was definitely a common thought that was put out by the intelligence community, which went something like that Al-Qaeda had one goal, and it was basically the reestablishment of a caliphate in Mesopotamia and establishment of Sharia law and many religious themes like that, which did not in any way describe 90% of the members of Al-Qaeda who actually just wanted, who had Sunni interests in mind, which were access to wealth in the new Iraq, protection from Shia militias, employment, and these types of issues.
In the first part of your book, you describe two men, Abu Ali and Zaydan, and describe how you played off each one of them because of their very different characteristics. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, and this is, you know, a very common law enforcement technique is when you capture two people who have worked together in criminal activity, you use variations of what's called the prisoner's dilemma, or you leverage the fact that neither of them knows what the other one is saying. And unfortunately, that's not something that's taught in the Army course unless you happen to have an instructor who's been exposed to it or done it. Then they might tell it to you on the side, but it's not part of the curriculum. And there's a lot of other techniques like that. For instance, you know, I mentioned briefly the boss introduction, where you bring somebody in who's supposed to be a supervisor and leverage that their position or status to mm-hmm. forward the interrogation. And so those are the techniques that weren't being taught at the Army course. But you know, I want to be clear, because in the past I've leveled some critique at the Army manual mm-hmm. and the Army course. Mm-hmm. My criticism really was focused on the fact that the methods weren't being taught in light of the culture. It's not that the Army methods in the Army field manual are bad. They're not. Mm-hmm. I have issues with a couple, but for the most part, they're actually very good methods. And as long as they're adapted for the culture, they're very effective.
But it's how
you teach them.
How would you take? Could you take one and say, this is how we did it before, but if we applied it, especially within the context of Iraqi's culture, the Iraqi culture, can you take one and move it from?
Sure.
Go ahead.
So, you know, probably one of the best ones would be pride and ego down, which is an approach from the Army Field Manual where you would lower the pride or the ego of a detainee. And first of all, it's an extremely difficult approach to run without insulting somebody or humiliating them or denigrating them or violating the minimum of treatment. But that said, the way that it was being used was people would try to use their religious beliefs or their participation in Al-Qaeda as something that was very shameful and that should be used to lower their pride. Which, one, from an effectiveness point of view, that's not what you want to do in interrogation. You want to build them up. Because once you lay that blame on them, you're just reinforcing that you're enemies and that this isn't someone you want to cooperate with. And so because our understanding of their culture was off, our application of that technique was misguided. What we should have been doing is understanding that and within the context of their culture, to fight jihad or holy war or to become a mujahideen is honorable. And whether or not we agree with that, that's the way they view it. When we understand that aspect of the culture and then we run pride and ego down, we can use that technique very differently, which is to say a holy warrior would not target civilians. Although we don't disagree with the fact that holy warriors have the right to fight. And in that way, the technique is now being run in a line with their culture, and they're supporting each other.
So with having a fairly complete understanding of the religious and cultural background of a country, what you're saying is that you can make a lot of headway along these commonalities, whereas coming in with a fairly belligerent mind or a fairly bigoted mind can get in the way. How can this help you get to what is true?
Well, it was absolutely vital to my success and to my team's success to be able to understand the culture and be able to talk about it. But we have to advance our cultural knowledge from what I call minus 1.0 all the way to 3.0. And let me explain that. So
sure.
When we stereotype a culture and get it completely wrong, we're now at minus 1.0. So everything we do is going to be negative. When we give our soldiers good cultural training, which we do in the Army Interrogators course, they have good training, but it's not the appropriate training for interrogators. And what I mean by that is they give you a long list of facts and things that are good to know so that you don't offend people.
Right.
So, for instance, you know, don't point the soles of your feet at somebody. The year that Muhammad was born, what's the difference between Sunni and Shia? Who are some of the leaders within the radical Islamic movement, you know, from the Muslim Brotherhood or others? So that's all great knowledge, but none of that's going to help you in an interrogation to convince somebody to cooperate. It'll help you not offend them. But let's advance that a step now. Let's take that up to what I call culture 3.0. Let's now say that you understand that within Islam and within Arab society that the theme of compassion and mercy towards one's enemies is a very common theme. In fact, one of the most famous stories in the Middle East is that of Salah al-Din, the Iraqi Kurd who defeated Richard the Lionheart in the Third Crusade and captured one of his commanders, Guy de Lusson, and spared his life. It's also common cultural knowledge.
These are key elements of the culture that an interrogator can use to advance cooperation.
You can cite lines of mercy and compassion from the Quran, and you can emphasize that both the detainee and the interrogator have obligations to treat each other with compassion and respect. And that forwards relationship building, and it forwards the interrogation towards cooperation.
It's pretty disturbing what people have done. And what if you have someone there who's responsible? How does that...
Well, first let me say it's not easy. I mean, it's never easy to be empathetic with somebody who's committed an atrocity.
Right.
And it's difficult. And you have that emotional response, what George C. Marshall, General Marshall, of World War II fame, called the beast in every man. But that's the difference between professionals and amateurs, right, is professionals go, okay, I feel this, but I'm going to set my emotions aside and do my professional duty. Now, can I teach somebody to be empathetic? I can't. I think it has to stem from a belief that everybody's human, even those who commit the worst crimes. But I never lost sight of the fact that they're still humans, regardless of the atrocities they committed. And for the people in Iraq, I can tell you about the few instances when I was interrogating somebody who I knew had done something extremely terrible, cut somebody's head off with a machete or executed kidnapped victims purely for profit. But that didn't describe 95% of the people we interrogated who had joined al-Qaeda because they needed protection or they needed weapons to defend themselves from Shia militias, or they wanted Sunni interests in Iraq. But even for the worst, it's just my personal belief, they don't stop being human regardless of what they do. And also, how you treat someone else is about you. It's not about what they've done. And so, I think as soldiers, as Americans, the object of this fight isn't to become our enemy, it's to defeat our enemy. And if we become them in the process, then we've lost. Al-Qaeda, one of their goals is to prove that we're hypocrites, that we say we believe in American principles, but we don't abide by them. And when we stoop to their level, then we're just fulfilling one of their objectives for them.
I find it an unfortunate truth, though, and I think it's part of why we have to confront any American behavior at any level. Value. There is not knowing the outcome, obviously, at the end yet, but with a detainee you named Youssef, where it had really gotten almost personal. You really needed to get information from this guy, and you came in and said, yesterday I was able to offer you two of your it was brothers, yes?
Yes.
And today I can only offer you one, and tomorrow I don't know what I'm going to be able to do. You need to work with me. So tell us about that.
The point of telling that story in my book is that you can be non-coercive, you can follow the law, and you can still run into areas where you doubt whether or not you've done what's right.
Mm-hmm.
I've had to do interrogations as a criminal investigator and interrogated people who I was almost positive were innocent. But because they'd been accused of something, I had to interrogate them to the best of my ability, because if I didn't, then people would always wonder, did they do this? And we don't know because they weren't interrogated fully. You know, it's and then when you do intelligence interrogations, it's the same way. You don't go light on someone because you suspect they're not involved. You do the best to your ability. Now, if you're accused of a fairly traumatic experience of being interrogated, even if you're innocent, and that's also part of war. In war, we're going to interrogate a lot of innocent people. And some of them are going to go through some extremely, you know, difficult. Doesn't mean they have to be unlawful or coercive. They can be difficult and still be non-coercive and still be ethical.
Okay.
In the case of the man you talked about, the guy who had two brothers, I was using an incentive approach and a love of family approach, which is I was appealing to both his love of his brothers, his obligation. It was also kind of culturally oriented because he was the oldest brother and had a cultural obligation to take care of his younger brothers. I was giving him a choice that I would help his younger brothers if he would cooperate. Very difficult choice. I would personally rather have somebody, you know, perhaps break my arm than make me to give me that choice. But the point is that it's non-coercive, and it's a love of family approach, and it's difficult emotionally, but it's not illegal and it's not unethical.
So, but there was a I found that the fact that you were able to walk in, first off, you considered ramifications of this moment that had maybe, at least for you, exceeded what was going on. And instead of waiting for the higher-ups to process it, you just walked right in there and said, I'm sorry.
Yeah, what I found in Iraq is that an apology goes a long way, a really long way. In fact, I think culturally it probably goes further there than it would here. And there's something very redeeming.
Do you think we apologize too much here when we don't necessarily step up behind it?
Do you mean we should be apologizing more when we make mistakes?
I think that there's also – I hear a lot of apologies, but I don't see a lot of change. So it's kind of – it's a two-way street. Either we're not apologizing enough or we over-apologize with no real value underneath it. So,
well, of course, you know, an apology has to be followed up with action. But some, you know, in the case of an interrogation, just the mere fact that an American would admit wrong kind of catches detainees off guard because they don't expect that.
Now, you did this a lot, actually, in the reading. People would want to talk about the past. You obviously weren't part of that past immediately. You know, you were as maybe a face of the American entity to them. But you would say, hey, look. What would you tell them? What would you say about the past American invasion and bad things, Abu Ghraib? How would you answer that criticism from them?
Well, I would say, look, we can dwell on the past or we can work in the future. But my point to them was, you know, we've made mistakes. America made a lot of mistakes in Iraq that we've acknowledged fairly publicly in all of which exacerbated the insurgency. And then, of course, Abu Ghraib and numerous other instances of torture and abuse, which led to a large influx of foreign fighters. And so what I would tell them is, look, hey, all those mistakes were made, and I can't change them. But what I can change is that we can work with now. Now, unfortunately, I was speculating. It was mostly wishful thinking. Because we had no program to work with Sunnis at that time.
Right.
It was just starting to really take root because the Marines had initiated really the start of what was the Anbar Awakening. But it made sense to them and to me that we should be working together. And so it ended up being a very effective approach.
Now, how close was your arrival related to the assault on the Golden Dome of Samarra?
Yeah, so I arrived exactly 1 month after the bombing of the Golden Dome.
And this was really a precipitating event for even more chaos.
Yeah, you have to kind of put it in perspective that, you know, the symbology of the Golden Dome Mosque, you know, within Shia religion in Iraq, you know, it's one of the most sacred sites. And so when it was blown up, you know, that obviously set off quite a bit of ethnic conflict.
And how are you utilizing this with the detainees you had as, you know, that you were highly focused upon?
Well, there was a lot of pressure to find Zarqawi because the thought that was verbalized to us was that if we kill Zarqawi, then we can slow down the suicide bombings, which lessens the conflict between Sunni and Shia and gives the Iraqi government a chance to stand up. So it was all about stopping their momentum. And Zarqawi was believed to be the key to that. We now know, obviously, that although our operations delayed suicide bombings and sometimes slowed them down significantly, even after his death, the attacks and the suicide bombings increased.
Mm-hmm.
So that it was fairly obvious that the war didn't hinge on any one person or eliminating any one person.
Now, the climax, I kind of don't want to give the climax of the book away because I want people to read it, but I think it's important in context. You were really close to not getting this linchpin, if you will.
Yeah, we, to try and not give away the end, but to build up the suspense, let's say that, you know, the man who held the key to Zarqawi was very narrowly transferred out of our prison.
Right.
Because it was thought that he was never going to cooperate. And the reason they thought that is because the interrogators who were interrogating him were using methods based on fear and control,
mm-hmm.
Which were the exact opposite methods that were actually appropriate for this mm-hmm. detainee. And so they got nowhere with those methods, and after 3 weeks gave up and decided they should transfer him. And that was when I took the opportunity to interrogate him for the first time and in 6 hours convinced him to cooperate.
And you got this almost on a glancing notice from your higher up. You said, I'm going to go.
Glancing's probably a good word.
I'm going to go do this. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And you took it. It's the inner narrative that you put there is where I most found myself in line with you, where your gut is telling you you have to put it on the line. You know, you're really driven. You know you've got something. And yet you're the only one in the mix, it sounded like. You were the only one there holding on to that feeling.
Yeah. I think I try to describe in the book, you know, from the time I arrived until, you know, all the way up until that moment, I was always kind of looked at as a little bit being, you know, not always entirely in line with the thinking of other interrogators who had been there a while.
Right.
One, because I had started teaching these law enforcement techniques, and two, because I disagreed with the view that people were taking of the culture or our enemies, and really was kind of, you know, also exacerbated by the case of Abu Beda, the man who cooperated based on a love of family approach, which I had advocated at from the beginning.
Right.
And had been rejected by some of the old hands as being naive. I think, you know, up to this point, I was kind of at odds with some of the other interrogators.
Well, in one case, you had actually gotten success, and then when you, I guess you found the roster that another person who had the control 101 conditioning had gotten a hold of that detainee, and that seemed to really hit your button.
Yeah, the problem is that some people are so, their prejudices against Arabs and Muslims are so ingrained that I'm not sure how you're ever going to convince them that they have to change their interrogation techniques, because first you have to change that prejudice. In a time crunch situation like in Iraq, you know, you can't start cultural training classes and prejudice eradication in a war zone.
Right.
That has to start before you ever get there. And so there are certain times, like in the case of Abu Haider, who was a man who led us to Zarqawi, I felt, you know, like I don't have time to go back and try and change the whole system and get people to understand that, you know, not every Arab is a terrorist. And so instead I just need to prove it to them by showing them the methods that do work when you take the proof will be in the pudding when the techniques that I'm advocating work.
Before I get to some of the domestic voices about terrorism, I wanted to ask you, I don't remember if this was from you, it's in my collective, you know, conflated memory pool, but someone had referred to interrogations in Iraq saying that, you know, after a while, a majority of the people were fighting were not necessarily part of al-Qaeda. They got into the fight because of what they saw at Abu Ghraib. They otherwise had intended to stay out, but once the photos came out, people were morally obligated to take up arms. Did that come across your bout? Was this from you, or I don't remember who?
Yes.
Okay.
What I said is I oversaw the interrogations of foreign fighters.
Uh-huh.
And it was taught to us from those people who are experts in that area to every single interrogator when we arrived, and it was ingrained in us that the number one reason these foreign fighters were coming to Iraq was because of the torture and abuse of Muslim detainees. And it wasn't just Abu Ghraib. It was also Guantanamo Bay. It was other places. So it was very clear, and there were statistics that were tracked that I'm trying to get released now.
Okay.
that show that this was the number one reason, and other officials like Alberto Mora have stated that they've seen them. Even John McCain, who went to Iraq and talked to prisoners, said that he believes it because he heard it straight from one of them. Some people will say, well, we weren't torturing and abusing detainees before 9/11. Well, that's true. We're talking about a difference of levels. The insurgency in Iraq was Sunni insurgents at the beginning. It was those people who were alienated by de-Ba'athification or when the army was disbanded. Basically, that policy very clearly led to the deaths of U.S. soldiers in Iraq because they died at the hands of those foreign fighters.
Okay, I'd like comments from you, if you're okay with that, on two two people who've spoken about torture. One whose comments about torture became the support, you know, the supporting column of advocates for the remaining time. You're familiar with the interview with John Kiriakou and Brian Ross of ABC back in 2007.
Yeah, and now he has recanted that he was there, right?
Okay, so aside from his recanting, I'm going to play the clip from the 2007 bit with Brian Ross, and where he clearly stated that we had that information. Aside from the fact that he was not there, aside from that he read this from a report, what's wrong with the idea that it takes 83, actually, if you really read the memos, more than 83 times, or 189 times? How at that point do we even call that effective? Or what's your thought on a technique? In fact, I'm actually put another question in there first before we get to that. What you had made comments before that there's basically no such thing as really an enhanced interrogation technique. So let's, before we deal with Kiriakou comment, what is your thought about this euphemism?
Well, it is. It's exactly that. It's a euphemism for torture and abuse.
So there's no such thing as an enhanced interrogation. There's either interrogation or it's really not exactly interrogation. It's something else. Would you say that's accurate?
You know, what I would call an enhanced interrogation is one that's effective, that's based on cultural understanding and modified for the culture and uses a technique that's beyond in effectiveness what we're using now or what we've traditionally used. You know, if you asked me what's an enhanced interrogation technique, I would say, well, what I call the boss introduction is a perfect example of an enhanced interrogation technique. It's borrowing from another discipline, sales. It's adapted to the culture and applicable to the culture and extremely effective.
Mm.
That's an enhanced interrogation technique.
So waterboarding someone 183 times produces what?
Nothing. It produces false information. But let's be careful also. Okay, first let's say this. There's no way any technique that if you have to use it 183 times is effective, and in no way quick, obviously. It's not fast. But let's also say this. the word that's continually used about the 183 waterboardings of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is that it stopped imminent attacks in the planning stages. Now, if there's not a bigger oxymoron than stopping imminent attacks in the planning stages, I don't know what is.
The ticking time bomb.
Yeah, so first of all, you know, the ticking time bomb would have gone off after the first waterboarding, or maybe the 100th, I'm not sure.
Right.
But it obviously isn't fast.
Right.
And so the waterboarding myths that are propagated, you know, are endless. Those who torture or want to support torture will always find a reason. I mean, it'll be efficacy, it'll be legal, it'll be moral, but they'll always find a reason if that's what they want to do. And history has shown that time and time again. If in the Inquisition it was to save our souls, in, you know, Algeria it was because it was for the good of the populace.
In Salem, you know, Massachusetts, it was to save our souls.
There's always a reason for torture. And that's why we had the CAT. That's why we had the Convention Against Torture. That's
right.
Why the United States, you know, the executive branch has clearly stated in public speeches that there is no exception to torture.
Ronald Reagan, the darling of the, I don't like using right and left, so I'm the darling of the people who love republicanism or the right. He basically signed our convention, last convention on torture in 88 and 87.
I don't remember the year of the convention.
But it was late in his term.
Yeah, and let's realize that when he signed that he realized fully that he was limiting executive power, that it was absolute, and that, you know, for those who are in the John Hughes school of executive prerogative, well, if that's true, and Ronald Reagan believed that, why would he ever even sign the CAT? It's because we do believe that some things are universal, including the prohibition against torture.
Mm-hmm.
And so all the people who support torture now want to do is reverse that, which is basically a regression in human rights that the international community has already accepted, you know, that we should be advancing in this area, not regressing.
I'm going to play a clip here from Mark Thiessen. This is from last year's Washington Journal. He describes what the job of an interrogator is. And then I want to talk about the LISP project. So here's Mark Thiessen. This is from Washington Journal from May of 2009.
In something that Abu Zubaydah said. The critics of interrogation say, well, enhanced, they use the word torture. It's not torture. But they say these techniques do not work because the person will say anything in order to get the techniques to stop. Abu Zubaydah says that's not so. Here's what Abu Zubaydah says about the program. He says, and this is what he told his interrogators. This is a quote from Abu Zubaydah, one of the key lieutenants of Osama bin Laden. Brothers who are captured and interrogated are permitted by Allah to provide information when they believe they have reached the limit of their ability to withhold it in the face of psychological and physical hardship. So in other words, what that means is that the terrorists are called by their faith to resist as much as they can, and once they have resisted to the limits of their strength, they can say anything. They are free by Allah to tell us everything they know about planned attacks, about the operations of Al-Qaeda, about Osama bin Laden and how he sends money and how he communicates with his operatives. And they did once at that. So the job of the interrogator, the questioner, is to help, is to give them something to resist so that they feel they've done their duty to Allah, and then they can give us the information we need to protect the country.
Mm.
Well, that's a great example of why speechwriters are not interrogators. you know, let me start off by saying this. Mark Thiessen's been given the opportunity to debate me twice in public and has turned down both times.
I would like to actually also extend the invitation to Mark Thiessen to come right here. I'll have Matt, and I would like to host that as well. I think that's a great offer.
But let's go back to his comments. First of all, Abu Zubaydah is not a key lieutenant of Osama bin Laden. We know that now. First of all, we know that he was basically a travel agent. So it's wrong to say that he could in any way speak about what Al-Qaeda members are obligated to do or not do. Secondly, what Abu Zubaydah said is the obligation of anybody who is part of a group who would be interrogated. I mean, me, our own troops, are taught, we're not taught to resist interrogations until our deaths. We're taught to resist to the utmost of our ability. Look at the code that we give, the code of conduct that we give our own soldiers. That's what it says. And so what he's saying, what Mark Thiessen has just said, is that our enemies are now authorized to waterboard us because we also have that same ethical value that we're supposed to resist to the utmost of our ability. And once we finish that resistance, then we can give information.
Is this what we want? Is this what Americans want? They want that in future conflicts
that our enemies can waterboard American soldiers. And if that's what they want, then they need to seriously consider the effects of that. The other problem with that is this. Why in the world would we ever take our interrogation strategies from the comments of Abu Zubaydah? You know, I would prefer to take our interrogation strategies from experienced interrogators, from other successful interrogation operations, World War II, Vietnam. I might turn to some experts, people who have done hundreds or thousands of interrogations, like Eric Maddox, who found Saddam Hussein. I might turn to Steve Kleinman, who's been in an interrogation.
I remember 60 Minutes coverage of George Pirro was a very fascinating show.
Yeah, I would go to people in the FBI like George Pirro or Ali Sufan, who have interrogated numerous Muslim extremists. I don't know. I might turn to interrogators rather than Abu Zubaydah, who was an Al-Qaeda travel agent. But apparently, you know, and this is the problem with Mark Thiessen's arguments, well, just one of the many problems. One is that he's anaphylactically allergic to anything military. What I mean by that is look through his book, look through anything he's ever written to see if you can find military interrogation expertise about interrogation methods, and you won't find it.
Right.
And the reason why is because what Mark Thiessen is he is the public defender in a war crimes trial. He is giving the opening statement to justify the war crimes that were committed.
That was handed him by Michael Hayden.
That's correct. And he's nothing else. Why anybody should listen to Mark Thiessen about interrogation methods that are effective or that we should be using is it just baffles me.
Well, we're also hoping to have a discussion here in the near future with Malcolm Nance, and I think that will be a very interesting view. He's offered a challenge also to Mr. Thiessen. So,
yeah, I understand that.
Well, before we head to the LIST project, I want to talk about that. I want to just say that, you know, my stepsister used to make us stand in the corner. And for reasons that had nothing to do with really punitive, it was just power when the parents were away. Eventually she'd come up and say, well, you know, are you ready to clean my room? Well, no. Well, you can put your arms up then. So you'd be in there another hour with your arms up. Now, after a while, this becomes a play, sort of. Especially, maybe not the first day, but over a period of years, you know, and it didn't last forever, by the way. But, you know, you do develop a sense of play with your captors that, you know, in the case of torture can lead to white noise, as some agents have called it, but also just, you know, you're really, you know, running down the wrong hole.
Yeah, you know... the last thing I would say about this, about in torture methods and expertise, is that to the American people, like, you can go to sleep at night knowing that in every conflict, interrogators have been successful without using torture. When it was in the Pacific against the Japanese in World War II, an enemy that some people have argued are extremely comparable to the ones we're facing today. Mm-hmm. Interrogation methods, non-coercive interrogation methods, were extremely successful. Go and read the history of Camp Tracy or talk to World War II interrogators and ask them what they used and how effective those techniques were. And in the same thing in the European theater against the Germans, and in Vietnam, we had men like Orrin DeForest and Stu Harrington who repeatedly used these techniques to success. Against even the most hardened enemies. And so, you know, if I was never an interrogator and I was just an American citizen and I knew my history, I would go to sleep every night confident that interrogators can do their jobs without using torture and abuse.
Tell us about the LIST Project.
So the List Project is a project to resettle in the United States Iraqis who worked for the United States government in Iraq and who subsequently faced retribution from Al-Qaeda or other insurgent groups. And there's numerous examples in Iraqis who worked for us, put their lives on the line, lost relatives because they worked for U.S. forces, who have sought asylum or have sought to come here to the United States. But many of them are still lingering in places like Jordan. And I think we have an obligation to those people to resettle them here because of the sacrifices they made for us.
And how can people find out about this?
They have a website, and I'm sorry, I don't recall.
I'll find the link, and we'll put it up with the article.
And but we need to be aware of this. You know, we've done this in other conflicts. We did it in Vietnam, and we know that we have an obligation to those people who have made sacrifices for us. You know, just to give you one example, you know, I had one interpreter on my team who was Iraqi American, who had three brothers assassinated because of his work for us. So, you know, we have an obligation to acknowledge those sacrifices that these Iraqis have made to assist us and to return that favor to help them.
By the way, that's a good final question. What do you think of the new administration and where we're headed?
As
a final thought.
I have mixed thoughts. One that I was very pleased, obviously, when we banned torture across all agencies in the government, when we shut down the black sites, and we announced the closing of Guantanamo, which hasn't happened. And so I thought there were positive developments in some areas. I was disappointed with the decision not to open up an inquiry and to look into war crimes. I don't think that it's necessarily a requirement to go forward that you can't go forward without looking backwards. We do that in the military all the time. We can do both. If that was our attitude towards all crimes, you know, we'd be in an awful place.
Right.
And so, but what I'm most concerned about is that torture has become a policy issue versus a legal issue or a moral issue. And so now we've made it presidential prerogative, if you will, to torture people, which the president can no more authorize torture than he can authorize murder.
But did he not just authorize murder, or will the death of Al-Awlaki be that? Will it be classified as that?
Well, again, that's outside my lane.
Oh,
so I try not to comment on that one.
It's above your pay grade.
Yeah, but in terms of interrogations and
sure.
torture and abuse, it's now become a matter of policy, which it shouldn't be, and it never was intended to be.
And when you hear these politicians in the Senate or such say, for instance, with Abu Mutallab or Faisal Shahzad, you know, they're immediately within minutes. In fact, I have to scramble to my various channels every day to capture the Hoekstras and the different people who did. You know, have we given him to the Hig yet? Have we handed him over to the military tribunals yet? You know, there's this gaggle of crows who comes out after each event.
Yeah, you know, they're talking now about modifying Miranda.
Yes,
legislatively. And I haven't formed an opinion on this, but here's what I'll say. If we do modify Miranda, and I'm not entirely opposed to that because I understand as an interrogator that I would want clarity on where that time limit ends for what we call the public safety exception. And so I can understand from an interrogator's perspective that they want that to be as clear as possible. Is it 3 hours? Is it 48 hours? What is the limit to the public safety exception? And that's only to everybody's benefit to have that be clear. But at the same time, what I'm worried about is how we're going to apply this. You know, if white supremacists in the Midwest who intend to assassinate governors conduct terrorist plots or are involved in terrorism, are we going to use the same exception against them as we are for Muslims or Arabs who are also involved in terrorist events? If it's applied equally, and there's a reason for it, then I'm not against it. But my fear is that it won't be applied equally, and that the law is only being modified to accommodate one specific type of terrorist, and that's a Muslim or an Arab terrorist.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. This has been, the book is How to Break a Terrorist with Matthew Alexander. This is a fantastic read, and I want to invite you back in the future. I hope you'll come back.
Oh, I'd love to.
And you have a wonderful weekend. You always let us know if there's any message you want to get out. If you want to ever post an article, we'd love to repost them for you, and you know, get this message out. And thank you for being with us.
Okay.
Have a good day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye.